This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Erica Wagner. She's written a book called Chief Engineer. The subtitle is Washington Roebling, the Man Who Built the Brooklyn Bridge. How are you, Erica?
I am very well and just thrilled to be talking to you today, David.
Me as well. And interestingly, while you are an American and you are from New York, which has something to do with the subject of this book, you are a resident of England.
Yes. So talking from London, where I've lived for a long time.
Right. Although you don't sound, you haven't picked up much of a British accent.
I hung on to my American accent. I decided to keep that as part of my identity, for better or worse.
Well, some people do, and other people end up with this sort of odd hybrid, not quite American, not quite British, but you sound actually quite American. I don't know whether that's good or bad, but I found this book really, really interesting in ways that I think surprised me. And I kind of want to start off by, asking you some questions about the book, but I don't want to miss out on some of the points that I thought were interesting that I think other people might be surprised by. So Washington Roebling was the son of John Roebling, who is quite well known as the, one of the great engineers of the 19th century, creator of wire rope, essentially, but also designer of bridges. John Roebling was a German immigrant who came to America and moved to a small town, established a town in Pennsylvania, as you outline in the book. It's what's really interesting, I think, about Washington Roebling. Well, there are many things that are interesting about him, and I'm kind of curious to. You talk a little bit at the beginning of the book about what prompted you to be interested in him in the first place, and maybe you could talk about that a little bit here, so listeners can get a feel for what it was that attracted you to Roebling in the first place.
Well, I have to say, as I sit here in my office, I'm looking at his picture, which I have on my desk. So what attracted me in the first place, he was very handsome. So, I know we don't get that in a podcast, but I am just putting that out there. But joking aside, I'm pleased to hear you say that there were many aspects of this book which interested you that perhaps surprised you. And I should start off by saying that I myself am not an engineer. I did an English degree, and in the rest of my life, I have worked in, I would say, the literary and cultural world. But there are so many aspects of Washington Roebling's life that, to me, are fascinating and significant beyond the realm of engineering, and which I think readers who perhaps don't think they have a great passion for engineering or wire rope or anything like that would find of interest, because Washington Roebling was the son of a fascinating but very violent father. He fought in the American Civil War, a great and significant conflict, of course, and one he kept a very good record of. He was a husband and father. His wife was a remarkable woman, Emily Warren Roebling. And of course, he built the Brooklyn Bridge, but he lived also to a great age. The Brooklyn Bridge was finished in 1883 when he was 46 years old, but he lived until 1926. He lived really well into the jazz age, one might say. So it was a life that spanned nearly a century, and a century of very important development and events in America's history, and Washington was part of that. How I encountered him, I grew up in New York City. I grew up, however, on the Upper West Side. I venture to say that when I was growing up on the Upper West Side, Brooklyn was perhaps a little less cool, wrongly so, I'm sure, to us Manhattanites. than it is now. So I do not remember that I set foot on the Brooklyn Bridge until I was 16 years old. But when I took a walk in December of 1983, I remember it, the Brooklyn Bridge's centennial year, as it happens, I was, as so many people have been before me, struck with wonder at this extraordinary structure, and also struck by the fact that I really didn't know anything about it. I'd just taken it for granted. It was always there. But who made it? How did it get there? And I started to read about it. And when I started to read about it, I met Washington Roebling. And I should say, because I'm a writer, I've always been a writer, one of the things that's wonderful about Washington is that he himself was a wonderful writer. And my book, Chief Engineer, is really filled with his voice. You will find a lot of Washington's own writing in my book. And I just felt I could hear him speaking to me. And I discovered that he had been, felt himself to be, pretty much overlooked. No one has ever written a biography of Washington Roebling. And that's what I set out to do. I set out to do it when I was quite a young woman. It took me a while, but I've done it now. But I want people to meet Washington as I met him all those years ago.
Well, I think you've succeeded. And I think, I mean, there's so many things that are interesting about him. I will talk about the first thing, even though this really isn't the first thing in the story. Well, maybe it is the psychological part of his makeup is really fascinating. And I think one of the things that I noticed is initially how conscious he was and how willing he was in that the journal, or I think this, you know, the writing that he did that you refer to, the manuscript you know, someone recently, more recently found that you referred to in the book, that he was so conscious of the effect of his father on him psychologically. He's pre-Freud. He's pre the psychological era. You know, I think the 20th century is the era of psychology, and the 19th century seems really different to me.
I think Washington's life and his account of his life, in a way, is a great kind of refutation to the idea that people in the past were completely different.
Exactly. Right. That's just what I wanted to talk about, that reading this made me realize how much more psychologically aware people were in that time, or maybe he was, but not everyone, but that the idea of a self-awareness of the effects, the psychological effects seen of parenting and other things that affected his life. It was really remarkable. It kind of changed my outlook.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that. But I think that's one of the things that draws us to Washington and made me think that I could really connect with him and understand him. And I hope that readers will see that too. And I also think we tend to tell ourselves things like, oh, well, in the 19th century, everybody accepted the fact that you were entitled to beat your wife and your children. And Washington's account of his very violent upbringing shows that this is not the case. He saw that he suffered a tremendous injustice at the hands of John Roebling, who he also believed was a remarkable man. One of the things to me that's so moving is his conflicted account of his father, who he both feared and yet knew he had to admire, did admire. And this is a kind of self-awareness too, this going back and forth that you see between admiration and disgust or fear.
Well, and also he lives this contradiction that you're just describing by, he doesn't reject his father and leave him. After the Civil War, he comes back to go to work for his father and essentially, as you outline, takes over when his father dies in an accident before the Brooklyn Bridge was even constructed. His father had designed it but hadn't started really building it. But he also has that horrible feeling that he's responsible for his own father's death.
Yes, that's right.
And that seems to be a really powerful impact on him that he lived. You know, he is not the kind of person who wallows in self-pity in any respect, but it clearly has an effect on him for the rest of his life. And his reaction to his father, obviously, although there, it's not, you know, there, this is one of the things about biography of people of that era. There are things that you can't know because there is no record for you to refer to, like the two brothers who ended up running the wire factory for a long period of time while Washington was building bridges. They obviously grew up with the same violent father. We don't really know very much about how they reacted to him. The fourth son, Edmund, we see was clearly destroyed by his father.
Yes. And I think especially Edmund, the youngest boy, by the time he was reaching any kind of reasonable age, Washington's poor, long-suffering mother had died. She died. She was a couple of years younger than I am now, Washington says, you know, worn out by abuse and hard work. And so Edmund, the youngest son, really didn't have the ameliorating effect of his mother. And his story is also pretty mysterious, but he clearly went off the rails. You know, one of the things that fascinates me, again, we don't know as much about what Charles and Ferdinand, the two younger brothers, thought about their father. But I think anyone who's lived in a family, and that's all of us, knows that different family members have very different experiences and reactions or willingness to give any kind of account about what happens in their own lives. And so I think we can, as 21st century readers, we can recognize that dynamic in this extraordinary family too.
That is true. And also then I'm thinking a little bit here, going maybe in a different direction, that Washington Roebling's life was very different from Ferdinand's and Charles's, to your point. Yeah. He also has the experience of being in the Civil War for the entire, well, almost the entire war, and is amazingly at Gettysburg. You know, I mean, this guy has, you know, he's
everywhere.
Yeah. And he's in important places and he plays an important role. And I mean, of course his father was hugely important and is famous as a bridge builder. And part of the problem that Washington had to deal with, as you point out, is for his entire life, people confused him with his father. Or said, you know, John Roebling built the Brooklyn Bridge, and Washington Roebling has to tell them all the time, no, I built the Brooklyn Bridge. He may have designed it, but he wasn't around for even the very beginning of it.
That's right.
Now, just to go back to this psychology, because I don't want to let this go by, this is really, this whole thing about health in this family is so powerful and so interesting. You know, the father, John, as hates doctors, but and believes completely in this sort of quackery of the water cure, which, you know, is not completely out of line. You know, he's a rational guy, but it's the 19th century, and there are medicine had not really formalized in that period.
He did take it to an extreme.
Yes, he did. And causing his own death. I mean, his son takes responsibility for it, but really John Roebling's ironclad unwillingness to deal with doctors is also the cause of his death.
Yeah.
Yes. So he gets tetanus. But Washington then has this, I think, a kind of psychological disturbance relating to health that is really interesting, because he's almost a hypochondriac, and yet the illness that he suffers from during the building of the Brooklyn Bridge, which you really, I think, was really interesting, this whole discovery then that the decompression for the Benz disease from going when they go underground to build the pilings, the caisson for the bridge, then the people who come up from it get compression illness. And he actually goes down into the caisson like everyone else does, and he gets the bends.
That's right. And I think, again, now, you know, we would think of someone who was the chief engineer of a project of that size and scale might spend most of their time at a desk. But that was absolutely not true for Washington Roebling. You know, he was down in those caissons, which are the deep foundations below the towers, both towers of the Brooklyn Bridge. He was down there as much or more as many of his men, and he became very ill with what we now call decompression sickness. Its cause and effects were not then understood. It was the beginning of its discovery, and indeed then it was called caisson disease. But how much, and of course I think one has to be very careful with speculating on or giving a kind of retrospective diagnosis to anyone, but it's hard to imagine that his brutal childhood, the effects of the extreme hard work, his suffering in the Civil War, combined with the effects of decompression sickness, did seem to have a lifelong effect on him. Plus, he had grown up, as you say, in this weird, paranoid atmosphere pertaining to health and diagnosis. So what was really going on with him is hard to pin down, but it's worth saying he lived to the age of 89. He outlived his brother, outlived his nephews. So he did okay in the end.
Right. And that's sort of what was striking to me. And we all have opinions about this, even though, as you say, it's not fair in a way. It's not reasonable to make suppositions, but it's hard to resist not putting it in a context that is somewhat your own. And it feels, you know, like my grandmother lived to be 89, but she had all kinds of ailments. And I always felt, and I, without any grounds of reality, you know, of scientific understanding of this, but it always felt to me that her struggle with her physical ailments actually made her stronger, and that, you know, that she was, her immune system was in hyperdrive all the time, fighting off all these neurological ailments, or maybe the neurological ailments were symptoms of something else. There's no way to really know, but it's sort of similar to this, that with Roebling, that you don't really know, but you have this, you kind of create a sensibility about it, which is probably not fair. It's certainly not scientific, but it is kind of emotionally satisfying, I think.
Yes. Well, that's what you have to do in a biography.
Right. Well, and of course you had, as a biographer, and I think you talked about this a little bit, there are so many, you have lots of information, and you certainly have the benefit of Roebling's writing, but you don't know enough about his wife, Emily Warren Roebling, who's very, very interesting in her own right, as you point out, and as was known at the time. And this is really interesting, that when he was invalided during the period of building the Brooklyn Bridge, his, you know, signature achievement in some ways, she essentially took over for him in relating to the bridge building project.
And that's correct.
You know, some people maybe gave her more credit than she was due, but in a lot of ways, you have to assume that she's due a lot of credit for
that. She's due an enormous amount of credit. And I think, to me, the question is the nature of the credit. And there are those who say that she was the first woman field engineer. I don't think that's quite correct. You can see from what is in the archives that there was never a moment, however sick Washington was, that he was not in command of this project. However, he would not see anyone except his wife. He could not bear anyone's company except for that of his wife. And she became this extraordinary intermediary between Washington and his assistant engineers, and also, of course, the political men who were in charge of the money. And she was a person of immense charm and tact. And he was not a person of tact. And even if he hadn't been sick, you know, she did certainly a much better job, I feel, than he ever would have done. In that regard, a friend of mine who is a fine engineer describes her role as being that of a project manager, which is an incredibly significant role. And there's no doubt that she understood a great deal, everything about what was going on in this project. It's worth saying that her older brother, she and Washington met during the American Civil War in 1864 at a ball in Washington. And she was the very much younger sister of his commanding officer, a man called General G.K. Warren, who's one of the heroes of the Battle of Gettysburg. And Warren himself was a surveyor and had great technical knowledge. And so she would have grown up around this kind of talk, too. And Warren loved his younger sister very much and also ensured, and this was not a given at that time, that she had a very good education, the kind of education that was given to women at the time, but he cared deeply for her education. So she had that too when she went into the marriage.
And as you point out, when they got married, Roebling had to assure her that she would not be essentially baggage, that she would not be, you know, hauled around as his mother was and forced to do menial labor and take care of children and do nothing else.
Well, or indeed not hauled around, but kept far away. She was very concerned. Emily expressed concern because John Roebling's wife stayed at home while John Roebling traveled the world building bridges, traveled the United States, it should be said. And Emily was determined that that would not happen to her. And it's worth noting, I think, that in 1867, 2 years before the Brooklyn Bridge was begun, John Roebling sent Washington and Emily on what sounds like a honeymoon, but was really a research trip to Europe to investigate all the most modern construction techniques that would be used in the building of the Brooklyn Bridge. And when they set sail on what was, in 1867, a pretty epic journey, Emily was pregnant. And I think for a woman to undertake a trip like that in that time when she was already pregnant says something about her character and toughness.
Right. And she had the baby in Germany.
That's right. She had the baby actually in Mulhausen, which is the town where John Roebling himself had been born in 1806. So that's a kind of nice symmetry. Their son, they only had one child, also called John, and he was born in Mulhausen.
So let's change directions a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about bridges and what they mean, because I think that even though there's so much of this book which is really about Washington Roebling's life, as it should be, but there's also something, you know, there's the poetry of the bridge, but there's also kind of the psychological and spiritual element to bridge building, you know, where you combine engineering and absolute beauty of, you know, of a kind of soaring nature. You know, these are really massive constructions that in that period, the late 19th century, was really a period of, you know, vast expansion in America. You know, I think many people are aware of, and around the world, you know, this kind of the growth of technology, of railroads and bridges and all this kind of massive change. But there's something really interesting about bridges that makes them romantic and in a real way. And I think it's partially this idea that the bridge, it does connect to places and gives motion where there couldn't have been before. But it's also, I really thought about this a lot as when I was reading your description of the building of the bridge, that you're going underground and under the earth at the same time as you're with a suspension bridge spanning distance through the sky. It's just so interesting to think about that.
It is interesting to think about that. And I think, of course, the Brooklyn Bridge, although obviously it is only between Brooklyn and what was then called New York, but it was begun 4 years after the end of one of the most terrible wars that's ever been fought anywhere in the world. And so I think bridges are always a symbol of things being brought together in a way that, as you say, seems almost miraculous. This, you know, a road where there couldn't have been a road before. Another thing I think is really special about suspension bridges in particular, but it's true of any bridge. If you walk across the Brooklyn Bridge and you put your palm around one of those narrow vertical suspender cables, the skinny cables that hang from the main cables, if you hold on to one of those, you will feel the bridge moving. The bridge is moving all the time. It looks like this great, totally stationary construction of stone and steel, but it is a living thing. It is always adjusting to the wind, to the weight that's put upon it, even the weight just of your footstep as you step across this. And to me, too, that's a really wonderful, exciting, really kind of magical aspect of this, as I say, seemingly stationary construction. It's never stopped moving from the day that it was begun.
Right. And there's actually one point where there was a point in time during I think after the bridge was built, the cable moved an inch. And this is because they were building, they had changed the loads, you know, and I think there was an accident or something. And the load rate, you know, much more traffic going across the bridge than originally planned. And the cable shifted an inch, and there was this panic, like, is the bridge falling? Do we have to get rid of it? Is it going to disappear? And Roebling just laughed and said, it's supposed to move an inch. You know, if it didn't move an inch, then the whole thing would fall apart.
That's right. That's right. So yes, I think bridges are and remain extraordinary symbols. You know, we say now, don't we, you know, build bridges, not walls. So that remains true.
That's true. And although, yes, bridges.
Not who you are, but you know, I know.
Yeah, but bridges make better neighbors than walls do. Right. But you know, another thing that is really interesting about Roebling and the whole enterprise is, and you alluded to this earlier, that, and I think this is so important when you look at the life of people like him, beginning in an era of, you know, it goes back to his father and the early days of his youth. It's the early 19th century, and he lives into the early 20th century. So he, in fact, is a bridge between eras that are so vastly different, and that he got to live. And you mentioned he didn't like cars, but he did eventually buy a car. I'm still interested in the way, how different the world was in terms of time. And as when you talk about their trip to Europe, they're gone for months. Communication is by telegraph, transatlantic cable. When he's in Brooklyn, you know, there's no, I think he's kind of early in the, I guess they're building the bridge before the telephone. I mean, there are things that they did that are so different from what we take for granted now. It always amazes me to think about how much they accomplished. And, you know, you can imagine, even though that bridge took, I think it was 14 years to build, that the accomplishment of it, given the technology of that time, is incredible. And the fact is, as you have him say, the bridge should last a century or more, a couple of centuries. Well, it will.
That's right. We're at 135 years now, 136 years. And it's still going strong. You know, there are certain, it is, again, as an engineer would tell you, in a sense, it could be described as functionally obsolete because it can't carry the loads that a bridge designed today could carry. It's why you can't drive a truck over the Brooklyn Bridge. So it has a weight restriction on it. But it's still going strong. It's crowded every single day. It's, you know, New York City is pretty good, relatively speaking, at maintaining the infrastructure that it has, better than a lot of places in the United States. The Brooklyn Bridge is a pretty iconic piece of infrastructure. I think it would be bad PR, you know, to let it go. And it's had several major facelifts over the decades and over the years. But those cables, you know, one thing that has not had any kind of facelift, which is really remarkable, those four great main cables, each one of them about 15, 16 inches across, those cables are exactly as they were on the day the bridge opened, May the 24th, 1883. And that is really extraordinary feat of engineering.
That is. I think, well, and the whole business that the Roebling family business was the wire cabling or the wire making, cabling being part of it, which is pretty remarkable. So, you know, that there was more than just the bridge building. They supplied cable for other bridges including the George Washington Bridge in the early 1930s.
That's right. The George Washington Bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge, and of course, many other aspects of the modern world too. Wire rope is involved in pretty much every aspect of the modern world. And one of the stories that Washington tells is that he believed his younger brother, Charles, who ran the company for a while, was exceptionally smart. And one day, a young Scotsman came to see him to buy some wire for a new invention of his. And the Scotsman was called Alexander Graham Bell. And Charles liked the sound of what this young Mr. Bell was up to. And so he bought quite a few shares in this newfangled invention early on. And Washington said, you know, he did pretty well out of that.
I would imagine so. It's like buying Apple stock in the early
days.
So there's one more subject that I really feel we should talk about a little bit. It's not really, it's not germane to the bridge building or his psychology, but I'm very interested in his interest in geology and minerals.
Oh, yes.
And then it turns out that his collection of minerals, I guess it was the finest in the world, held in private hands. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that part of his life, because it went to the Smithsonian. So anyone who's really interested in geology and minerals will know about this. But I think I didn't.
But it is germane to the building of the bridge in one very fascinating respect. So yes, his great passion was geology and mineralogy, and he became pretty much the finest collector of minerals anywhere, certainly in the United States, perhaps in the world during his lifetime. His aim was to collect one of every single kind of mineral. This was not possible. He knew he would not achieve this aim. After his death in 1926, he gifted this extraordinary collection to the Smithsonian Institution, where it really formed the basis of their mineral collection. And one of the conditions of the bequest was that it never be split up or sold. And so all of it is still there. Some of it's on display. Some of the more spectacular items are on display, but quite a lot of it is in storage. They all still have Washington's labels on them, his little handwritten labels. But there did come a point where his deep understanding of geology had a great deal of bearing, and still does, on his greatest work. So the caissons of the Brooklyn Bridge were sunk, as I said before, deep beneath the riverbed by the standards of modern bridge building, not that deep. The Brooklyn caisson is at about 46 feet below high water, and there they struck bedrock and they could stop the digging because you want the towers to rest on bedrock. On the New York side, however, they knew from the test borings that they had done that the bedrock was much deeper down. By the time they got to about 70 feet below high water, the decompression sickness was really getting to people. The workers were getting really sick, and nobody knew what to do about this. At 78 feet, they're digging what is effectively through sand, and they hit a spur of bedrock, of the gneiss that forms Manhattan Island, this very hard rock. But it's just a spur. But Washington, with his knowledge of geology, sees that this spur of bedrock is very sharp, and it's never been affected, he says, by the rounding action of water or ice. Therefore, he figures that nothing, none of this sand has moved for at least 100,000 years. So he decides to stop the boom. That's his decision, and his decision alone. He trusts his knowledge of geology, that what he's hit is good enough to found it upon. So another thing that you can think about when you walk across the Brooklyn Bridge is that the New York Tower effectively rests on sand, but it's done fine so far. And that was Washington's call and his understanding of what was underneath Manhattan Island.
Oh, that's great. Well, that kind of ties in his, I think the mineralogy that makes it wraps up the interest, so you can understand why he was so fascinated with minerals as well. So tell me, I guess, having completed this some time ago, is biography something that you plan to pursue with other subjects, or will you go back to other types of writing?
I do all kinds of writing. I'm a journalist. I am a novelist. I'm a short story writer. Washington still won't leave me alone. I would say that he will always remain in my mind, I will say. I'm working on another nonfiction book at this point. But I do find that his life is still, to me, endlessly fascinating. You know, one of the difficulties about writing a biography is, of course, you as the biographer are fascinated by everything. You have to be pretty strict with yourself in being aware of what really draws you and how you're going to keep telling a story, you know. And that's certainly what I try to do in this book, and that's what I'm interested in all of my writing. I'm fascinated by storytelling of every variety. I teach creative writing at Goldsmiths, which is part of the University of London, and I work with all kinds of writers. I work with life writers, with memoirists, with fiction writers, short story writers, and I'm always fascinated by the stories people have to tell. That's what draws me. And Washington's story, as it was told, but especially as he told it about himself, has always been incredibly moving and a very significant part of my life.
Well, it is a wonderful book that you've done, and I really appreciate talking to you about it. So thank you. And I look forward to talking to you another time about a different book. So this is Writer's Cast. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Erica Wagner about her book, Chief Engineer, Washington Roebling, The Man Who Built the Brooklyn Bridge. Terrific book. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David.